It's the Magnets for Dummies edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, what I learned, Syrian refugees, sense of science, magnets in perpetual motion, and cryptid corner. What's a cryptid, and is the Kraken real? Let's begin episode 311.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, we start with a new segment, What I Learned This Week, with new co-host, Gulid. This week, we talk about Syrian refugee crisis and the global response. Let's begin. Hi, Gulid. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Not bad. So, Gulid, tell me, what have you learned this week?
Well, I just heard about Hungary closing down their southern border to Serbia. They're trying to get control of the migrant crisis going on. And interestingly enough, they've been resistant, I'll use that word, towards the Syrian refugees trying to come over to Europe, especially their country.
Might I strengthen that? I think resistance is very diplomatic of you. I would call it racist. I mean, what was it? The president of Hungary said that we don't want these Muslims coming in and destroying the Christian nature of Europe. It's a bit stronger than resistant.
Yeah, and also against the law. But yeah, I was also watching the clip of the Hungarian camera woman. I think her name is Petra Laszlo, that was tripping refugees that were running from the police. And it wasn't just like, you know, sticking her foot out and tripping like a man. She was tripping someone carrying a child and women.
I saw that one with the child, and yeah, like she went out of her way and she tripped. And like that kid probably got hurt because, you know, dad landed squarely on her. It was quite despicable.
Yeah, and I can't say the Prime Minister is any better for the statement he made.
How do you feel about the fact that she apparently lost her job? Actually, first of all, do you know where she worked?
No, I didn't know.
She actually worked for like a very ultra right wing neo-Nazi type newspaper / party trumpet. I'm not sure what the right word is there. When she was tripping them, she was like, you know, let's get these dirty people out of this country because they're bad. And the funny thing about that, so why, you know, is she the kind of person to do this? Obviously, she belongs to a neo-Nazi newspaper, but the fact that they fired her over it was quite not funny. Doesn't seem to be quite word, but it's like, you know, Hitler firing someone for being anti-Semitic, you know, it's like,
yeah,
that's sort of your whole thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think they just didn't want so much negative media attention from other countries as well, ironically enough. And there was also a news memo leak of the Hungarian media saying they didn't want photos of Syrian children being put out just because, well, the idea was that they didn't want too many people feeling sympathy for the situation and then holding them accountable for what they're doing and what they're saying.
That reminds me, and I think you might have something to say about this, about, you know, the famous quote from Stalin, which has been repeated a billion times, you know, one death is a tragedy, but 1,000 is a statistic.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I've learned, you know, over the past week what that really means, because the story of the 3-year-old drowning just sort of put everything into perspective for a lot of people, even though this has been going on for a really long time.
It's funny, actually, a lot of agencies, you know, the charities. It's funny that a lot of charities know this, and that's why whenever they do their advertising, they don't show you masses of people. They focus on the one little kid who, you know, you can change their life. When it's funny how the human mind works, you know. We can relate to one person suffering, but we can't seem to relate to multiple people suffering.
Yeah, and with that, I mean, sponsoring children is really popular because you get, you know, the picture and the letter, and you get that really close connection with that one person rather than sending money to, like, a community or, like, a large group of people.
So it seems quite obvious that, you know, countries like Hungary, Poland, there's a few others that are in there that are very xenophobic, have, you know, said, hey, we don't want these people. They've put up the razor wire, you know. I mean, honestly, it's like treating them like animals. It's really disgusting. These are human beings, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So what do you think about that part of it?
I think it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, I read somewhere as well this week, something else I learned is that a majority of refugees are stay in developing countries rather than the developed, the richer, more resourceful countries. And that really surprised me because I thought that, you know, with the developed countries, they'd have more to offer, more resources. They'd be better able to accommodate these people looking to get away from, you know, the chaos of where they're from. And you have countries that are, you know, not as resourceful or not as wealthy, yet still accepting these people with open arms.
I was, these statistics are off the top of my head, so they may be a little fuzzy. But yeah, when you break it down, it's something like 1.4 million are in Turkey, about another million in Jordan, almost another million in Lebanon, you know, and Europe itself, which relative to the other one, have taken in 350,000. You know, I mean, Germany said it might take up to 500 or 800,000, which is really good. But even they've been kind of backing down from that by saying, listen, we don't want everyone over here. But yeah, if you think of it, those numbers, I mean, even if every Syrian refugee, which I think is somewhere around 4 million if you include internally displaced, yeah, is a drop in the bucket for Europe.
Yeah, definitely. And Europe, a continent as a whole, is taking less than, you know, these one individual countries, which I think is crazy. I think Germany is taking a step in the right direction, but there's a lot these other countries can do as well.
It's funny because I was sort of chiding Canada's response to the Syrian crisis when compared to Germany, and then having learned a bit more information that actually we're I guess we can't say we're not good, but we're just as bad as almost all the other quote-unquote developed nations.
Yeah, definitely.
What do you think about the idea, though, that maybe it's actually better for most of these refugees to keep them in Turkey, with the idea that, again, statistics tend to show that most refugees actually do return home once the crisis that caused them to leave is over? So if you kind of kept them in Turkey, they'd be sort of closer to home.
Well, I think it's going to take, you know, a lot of time for things to sort of resolve and recover back where they're from, in Syria. And, you know, in the meantime, you know, life still happens and there's a lot we can do to accommodate them and still help them be safe. You know, being close nearby is a great thing for them because when things do resolve and recover, they can come back and sort of return to their lives and be proud of where they're from. But I mean, for the time being, there's definitely more that we could do while this is going on.
I think you said that quite well, actually, that, you know, people's lives need to continue. And the Syrian conflict has been going on for 4 years. There's no prospect of it ending anytime soon. So those people who say, well, you should just keep them close at hand, are basically saying these people should be kept in suspended animation. Their lives should stop. Children should cease being children and growing up until, yeah, you know, this goes. And I think you're right. You know, the idea of the West taking on more, we have the capacity, we have the resources. And I've mentioned previously on a show that it tends to be very much a win-win situation. You know, yeah, European population is aging. They need a new infusion of youth to help pay for their social services.
Yeah.
But what about the other argument I've heard about that countries like, well, basically the Arabian Peninsula, all of the Emirates, Saudi Arabia and all that, have taken in zero refugees. And get me wrong, they have claimed that they have given up about $500 million in support for the refugees in other nations. But when you figure in the United States, which granted is rich, has spent, I think, about $41 billion. They built something like the world's tallest building for like $40 billion. And all they're offering is like $500 million and taking in nobody?
Yeah. I was actually watching this news clip, and it is by Fox News, so brace yourself. They were saying that America was sort of hesitant to take in these refugees because they sort of fear ISIS members being among these Syrian refugees. And I was just sort of like, really? Like, that's, you know, a lot of these are children. And that's really what you're focusing on?
Well, they're parroting the concurrent leader of this nation who has similar reservations.
Yeah. And, you know, I just thought it was, you know, Islamophobia, sort of. You know, they are from the Middle East. They are Arab, so they have that negative stigma on them. And then with the whole ISIS threat going on, I don't really think that justifies how they're responding. But then I also thought about all those other, you know, Arab nations that are nearby that are Muslim countries, you know, that don't have that same prejudice, yet are still taking in no one. So I'm not 100% sure. I think it's really messed up.
I know there's two angles to go here. I'm going to finish up with one thought with the security risks. Because most people give ISIS to have about maybe, you know, 30, 50,000 troops or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And if you think, you know, let's say all of them left Iraq and Syria and said, we're going to try and sneak into Europe to be, you know, the fifth column. That we're going to be the fifth column. Well, one, what are the odds that they're actually going to get through? Because, I mean, we've seen the resistance going through there.
Yeah.
And even if they get through, what are the odds they're going to end up in any place that they kind of plan to, let alone be able to do anything harsh? I mean, it's a ridiculous idea that these people are a genuine security risk. And the flip side to that argument is even if, heaven forbid, worst case scenario, someone comes in and there is something like, I don't know, a Charlie Hebdo or something, right? And 20 or 100 people get killed, which would be horrible.
Yeah,
but how many thousands are dying in the Mediterranean and on their way into Europe that wouldn't have to die if they just let them all in?
Yeah, and that's definitely very true. And I think, you know, a lot of the smugglers are actually benefiting greatly from Europe's resistance to the crisis situation. They're benefiting off the desperation of the people, of how badly they want to escape and have a better life. And there are a lot of, you know, parents that can't afford or don't have the money for the whole family to get on the boat. They'll put their kids on the boat, even though that's not even the safest, but it's not the safest option, but it's really the only option they see. And then the UN was sort of talking about how they need a crackdown on the smugglers, when really Europe sort of opening their doors would be the greatest way to do that, I feel.
It's funny because I remember watching one of the clips about the Syrians, and they had a mother sit there and say, listen, I know there's a good chance or a strong possibility that my child might die if I try and send them to Europe, but I know they're definitely going to die if they stay here. And that's that kind of desperate choice that is horrific. But there's another aspect going back to the Saudi Arabia, and I'm not sure, maybe you don't know this or not, but a lot of the Arab Emirates have their economic foundation is on immigrant labor. So the actual number of sort of Saudis in Saudi Arabia is like a fraction of the total population. And a lot of them come from like the Philippines and India and all that. And I wonder if part of what's going into, I mean, they claim they're worried about instability and, you know, terrorist threats as well. But, and this is where I'm going to play the religion card, is in their own minds, it's okay for them to discriminate and treat non-Muslims as sort of slave labor, because there's lots of talk about how people who are building the football stadiums in Kuwait and all that are just, sorry, Qatar, are just being treated horrifically. But if they allowed these refugees in, they couldn't treat them as badly, at least maintaining their faith, because they are fellow Muslims. Or maybe I'm nuts on that.
Oh, no, that is true. In the, you know, sort of in that, in the religion, that is a strong belief that you cannot do that, you know, for people who are in that religion, they're seen as brothers and sisters, and you can't really treat each other that way. Of course, you know, what that belief is found on, you shouldn't treat other human beings that way as well. You should probably take that one step further. But yeah, I think that's unfortunate that that's the case. And I think that should be applied to other people as well, even if they don't share the same beliefs as you.
I think this ties back into another thing when we were talking about how the only people really benefiting or prospering from this are the people smugglers. And someone had come up, and I can't remember where I heard this from, but they had mentioned that, well, first of all, we should go back. Refugees have a very strong legal status in the world. There's UN conventions on what happens to a refugee once it enters your country. So once someone comes into Canada and they claim refugee status, there is a whole bunch of legal protections that pop into place, and you know, you have to take them. They have to sort of have a trial, and they have to, you know, you can't just send them home like you would with migrant workers. And this has a very sort of weird effect in Europe, and one of the reasons why the European Union adopted this policy that you can apply for refugee status in the country you arrive in, i.e. Greece, Italy, or Spain, but you can't apply anywhere else. And the reason is if someone does get to Germany and say, hey, I'm a refugee, then Germany can't just kick them out. Germany has to take responsibility for them. So in a very perverse way, most of Europe wants the drug smuggling to fail, that they want these people to sort of not make it, because as long as they end up, actually, maybe I got that wrong.
No. I've read a similar statements as well. They want to make it as hard as possible for the refugees to come on over, because once they're actually there, they have to sort of be accountable and take responsibility and not just ship them back.
And that is a crime against humanity.
It is, definitely. You know, again, you criticizing Europe, you know, us as, you know, Canadians and North America in general, well, U.S. and Canada, we're not doing too much better. But there is a lot that all of us collectively can do.
Yes. I think on that note, we'll call the segment to an end.
Okay.
I knew I had a problem.
I tried counting calories, eating and eating.
Nobody else could possibly understand.
We understand. We're Overeaters Anonymous, and we have helped thousands of people stop their compulsive eating and start living a healthy, rewarding life.
With OA, I am living again and loving it.
Start living the life you deserve with help from Overeaters Anonymous. Find us on the web at OA.org.
Hello and welcome back. A Sense of Science, a regular segment where we explore and explain some of the basics of science that we all know, or do we? This week, what's up with magnets? Insane Clown Posse lived up to their name by asking, feckin' magnets, how do they work? And well, on one level, that sounds like a silly question. And don't get me wrong, the posse are, how shall we say, intellectually challenged. But their question is not as silly as some of us, perhaps ivory tower types, might think. I had an interesting conversation with, quote, an open-minded individual. A little too open, I discovered, as the conversation persisted. But one topic that came up was perpetual motion machines. And he knows that they exist, because he saw them working on YouTube. And even if those weren't 100%, they were based on magnets. And well, magnets are, the magnetic forever. So there had to be something there. My first thoughts, and much to my credit, not my first words, were, come on, fella, don't you know about conservation of energy? You can't get something for nothing. That those videos are either charlatans or idiots. As I said, first thoughts. But then I thought a second time, a good habit to get into, and realized I knew a platitude, but not the actual answer. What was the question? Where do magnets get the energy to keep themselves magnetic? Now, a number of my loyal listeners to Radio Freethinker just harumphed, a gasp, or a chuckle. The answer is basic, but not, I think, obvious. Obviously, I had to think about it. First, what is magnetism? We need to understand that natural magnetism is a result of atoms lining up. No, before we go there, let's get a little quantum. Electrons are one of the rare cases where quantum effects can be seen on the macro scale. You see, electrons have fundamental properties like mass and charge. They also have a property called intrinsic magnetic moment. But I think of this as little tiny bar magnets. Why bar magnets? Well, it's just a fundamental quality. It's like asking me, why does it have a charge? Who knows? Well, perhaps a theoretical physicist might have an idea. But to you and me, it's an electron. Each has its magnetic quality that I'm going to call barness. Now, every electron has a positive or southern side and a negative or northern side. Bar magnet orientation. Now, each atom has a number of electrons orbiting them. And it is these electrons that give objects their natural magnetic charge, which is not really charge, but again, an intrinsic value. That's important later on. A little side note. Protons, which are also charged particles, also have barness, but their strength is orders of magnitude smaller than that of an electron. So they don't really count. Why smaller? Science! Okay, moving on. Now you might know that moving magnetic fields generate a current, which in turn generates a magnetic field. So if you have a bunch of electrons, each really tiny bar magnets, whipping around the nucleus of an atom, well, they should generate a current or electrical field, and they do. But thanks again to the quantum nature of electrons, these fields cancel each other out. Of course, this assumes that every electron has a partner, a countervailing body to cancel out with. But in atoms that do not have full shells, shells in this case are levels of an atom that have a full and usually neutral complement of electrons. But for an element with a half-filled shell, all the electrons lack a partner, so there's no cancellation, and the atom gains a magnetic field, i.e. the atom itself gains barness and becomes a little tiny bar magnet. Okay, so those of you who just rushed to your periodical table to find out what elements are magnetic might now be asking, well, if that's true, why is chromium not magnetic, when it has a similar shell structure to copper or molybdenum? In fact, chromium is classified as an antiferromagnet. What's up with that? Well, this is where quantum meets macro, or the real world. Even though each atom has barness, the metal, i.e. a large grouping of the elements, does not because of how the metal forms. This is where we move from atoms to crystals. Metals have a structure. We call this structure its crystalline form. Now metals, well, nature itself is a lazy ass. By that I mean, when an atom forms, it chooses a crystal structure that requires the least amount of effort or energy. So some elements, when they form crystals or metals, it's usually metals but not always, when they form the crystalline structure, think of it as like putting together a bookshelf from IKEA. Sometimes the barness aligns and you get a magnetic or ferromagnetic material, or they cancel each other out, anti-ferromagnetic material. The term ferro comes from iron, or its classical Latin name, ferrium, which is the most magnetic metal in nature. Okay, but again, I can hear some listeners yelling into their speakers the words, cast iron is not magnetic, it's made of iron, what's up with that? Well, as you may have noted, we're moving up in scale. The metals are not the end point. Cast iron and other composite objects are not strictly speaking one thing. Cast iron, for example, is made up of iron, but not the same iron all over. Okay, what the hell am I talking about? Let's start the idea with a lump of iron is magnetic, but we put a bunch of lumps of iron into a pot. We melt them and cast, see that cast, as in tossed at random, into a pot mold. That pot is not a single lump of iron, but an amalgam of iron bits. Each of those bits may be magnetic, be it up or down or left or right facing. but the one next to it may be in an opposite or different alignment. And remember that magnetism depends on barness of all its component parts pointing in the same direction. In the case of cast iron, the bits are pointing randomly. Or, like with the quantum atom, the barness value cancels out and the object as a whole is no longer magnetic, even though all its parts are. Weird or what? Caveat: random does not mean they cannot align. Just it's unlikely. So even cast iron could be magnetic, if only slightly. Second caveat: magnets, even on the atomic scale, can be moved if not changed. As I said, usually the field, so let's change our term of barness to magnetic field. Well, these fields are not unchanging. If you heat a metal to a certain temperature, the atoms and the crystal can align to an external field orientation. This is what happens when magma from a volcano cools. It will take on the orientation of the planetary magnetic field. This provided some of the strongest evidence for continental drift. How? Well, taking readings of the magnetic orientations of the Atlantic Ocean floor, it was observed that there were bands of orientation. That is, a band may be pointing to magnetic north, others to magnetic south. When it was realized that the Earth's magnetic poles reversed over time, this correlated to the bands. That is, as magma erupted over time, it had a barness equal to the poles of the time. This provided a timeline of the expansion of the Atlantic and thus proving plate tectonics. Okay, so how does this relate to perpetual motion machines? Well, to understand that, we need to understand unnatural or electrically induced magnetism. So far, we've been talking about properties innate in material. Natural magnets are magnetic in the same way that a kilo of sugar is a kilo. It's a property of the universe. But not all magnetic fields are natural. Almost 200 years ago, Michael Faraday discovered that magnetism and electricity were essentially two sides of the same coin. That is, magnets could generate electric current, and electric current could induce magnetic fields. Science for the win! That said, the type of magnetism from what we've been talking about are really very different. So far, we've been talking about innate magnetism, quantum effects writ large. And on a technical level, electromagnetism is the same. But in a real-world way, it's very different. Remember that natural magnetism was ultimately based on a fundamental property of electrons. You may also be realizing that electricity is the flow of electrons. We have a connection of sorts between electricity and magnetism. As electrons travel through a wire, they induce a magnetic field just like they do in atoms, metals, and crystals. But unlike those types, current is not an object, but an action. That is, electrons moving through something as opposed to just being part of something. Now, I should mention to the nerdier listeners, complimentarily speaking, electromagnetism is actually a result of relativity. But for now, it's magic. Well, not really, but this is the Magnetism for Dummies edition. So remember when we said that crystal structures that aligned the barness of electrons created a magnetic field? Well, electrons traveling through a wire does sort of the same thing. In this way, we can create a magnetic field out of essentially nothing. But there is a cost, and that's energy. Unlike natural magnets, those energy costs were paid in their formation. Electromagnetic energy needs some form of external power supply. It's the flow of electrons that create the current, which creates the magnetic field. Faraday also understood the opposite was true, that if you rotated a magnetic field through an electric wiring, it could induce an electrical current. Aha, you might say. So magnetic fields are energy, and that a permanent magnet should be able to provide permanent energy. Alas, no. The first law of thermodynamics, the law of conservation of energy, states that in a closed system, energy cannot be created or destroyed, but only transformed. Here we turn to my friend who believed in the perpetual motion machine. This law would have one of two consequences. Either a perpetual motion machine would need an external source of power, i.e. it's not a closed system, or we require energy being transformed. One could think of the atom bomb, where matter is transformed into energy. But the atom bomb is not perpetual. And a perpetual motion machine that requires external power is no different than a battery-powered motion machine. At this point, you might be saying, But if magnets are permanent and they can create electricity, is that not perpetual motion? Alas, again, no. The fault in logic is the closed system. You see, magnets do not induce electrical current. It is the kinetic energy. It is the rotation of the magnet that creates, or more appropriately, transforms kinetic energy into electrical energy. Let me put it this way. Now keep in mind, these are not the same on one level, but it does help demonstrate the idea. We're all subject to gravity, the force that pulls us towards the center of Earth. Okay, for the moment, let's say it's an object, a block of wood for instance, falling towards the floor. When the block is on the table, it still has gravity, mass, but it's inert. It's not moving. There is no action, no work has taken place. Mass is just a property of the block. Now, if I lift the block off the table and then let it go, the block becomes active. There is momentum as it drops towards the floor. Work has been done, energy released. And we can honestly say that gravity produced that energy. But the source of the energy was not gravity itself. It was the transference of the mechanical or kinetic energy of my arm lifting the block up. If we did the math, the energy required to lift the block was equivalent to the energy released in dropping it. And a little less. No reaction is perfect. Now, gravity is, from a fundamental force way, a good analogy to understand magnetism. But I still think one could argue, well, gravity powers the sun, indirectly. So yes, perpetual motion machines are real, or at least possible. And again, no. So let's go at this another way. Let's pretend that water is magnetism. And you have a pot of water sitting on the stove with the lid on. That is your bar magnet. It's just there. But wonders can occur when energy is applied. If we turn on a burner, the thermal energy of the stove will induce into the water, with the water becoming steam, and the steam raises the lid. We see that all the time. If we think of water as merely a fundamental force that transfers the thermal energy of the burner into the kinetic energy that lifted the pot lid, when we stop applying the heat, the motion ceases, there is no energy, and the lid settles down. But the water still remains. Even though it induced energy, that induction was simply moving one kind of energy to another. To close the analogy, using one of those hand-cranked emergency radio, the kind so handy when the power goes out, when the crank is turned, that's like the burner on the stove. You are simply supplying kinetic energy. As the water moves around, so does the bar magnet in the radio. In the way that water transformed the heat into lift, i.e. lifting the lid, so does the magnet transform kinetic energy into induced electrical energy. As long as you're cranking, the magnet will do the conversion. And when you stop inputting energy, the magnet has none of its own. So the flow of electricity stops. So we now see, and I must admit, it took me a bit of research to actually understand the technicalities of what I actually knew academically. Knowing something like the laws of thermodynamics is one thing, but seeing them in the real world, that can be wonderful. And at times a little uncomfortable. That's all the time we have for this segment. We'll be right back with Cryptic Corner.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
And we're back. So this is the first edition of Cryptid Corner. I'll start with, what is a cryptid? It's an animal or plant whose existence has been suggested but has not been discovered or documented by the scientific community. And a cryptid corner, well, that's when we use the portion of Radio Freethinker as an opportunity to discuss that as yet mythical unconfirmed creature and delve into what the creature is and its supposed habitat. We'll then view that information with a skeptical eye and dissect the evidence said cryptid exists, what its investigations have been done, and the current plausibility said creature actually exists. Now, this is not a let's make fun of stupid people's beliefs discussion. That I say for my comments on religion. No, this is not as delusional in that there have been a number of fantastical creatures that have actually proven to be real. The mountain gorilla, the platypus, and others. Now, I was going to start the series with Bigfoot, with the aim of enlightening those who may actually believe this creature exists. But having said that, this is not intended to be a hatchet job. I will save that for perhaps future episodes. Now, this week, we'll start with an explanation of what really qualifies as a cryptid. For this definition, I'm going to be generous and use Fringe Science's own definition. This is from the Journal of Scientific Exploration, a magazine set up in the 80s by those investigators who wished to establish a form for three main fields that have been largely neglected by mainstream science: UFOlogy, cryptozoology, and parapsychology. Okay, Fringe might be a bit generous. When talking about Rome, one should at least talk to a Roman. At least once. So accordingly, to this source, there are about 10 categories of cryptids as such, with 6 criteria that would disqualify one incidentally, if that's the right word, that could be a real cryptid. First off the post are distributional anomalies. That would be like an elephant on the prairies. Basically a known type of animal found outside its expected habitat. Let's call these misplaced species. Not a cryptid because the animal actually exists, but not where it should be. Of course, they could be reclassified in the next category should more information be discovered. The second would be undescribed, unusual, or outsized variation of a known species. These are basically a known species, but with some unusual characteristic, like a wolf the size of a bear. It still has the characteristics of a wolf in every way but size. I'm calling these anomalous cryptids. These are like known species, but are not actually that species, thus cryptid instead of species. The third classification would be the survival of a recently extinct species. This is a creature assumed to be extinct, but may not be. There's been much talk in this vein regarding the ivory-headed woodpecker or the Tasmanian tiger. These are classified as prematurely extinct species, as in we got it wrong declaring them extinct. Again, the existence of these creatures are not in doubt, only their extinction is questioned. Number 4 on our list is lingerlings, or species known from fossil records that may have survived much later into historical times than currently thought. This captures creatures who we know only from paleontology, but there may be evidence that they still exist. The most prominent cryptid on this list is the woolly mammoth. Let's call this one lingerling fossil species. Again, we know woolly mammoths were real, therefore a species, and we largely know them from fossils. But they're not only thought extinct, but very extinct, really only found in the fossil record. In the number 5 spot, and related to number 4, are species known from fossil records that died off millions of years ago, and yet may still be alive. Think of the movie King Kong, the remake where the island that time forgot, basically dinosaurs. Some claim they're still here. We'll call this one premature extinct fossil cryptid. Like our premature extinct species, these are creatures we thought were extinct but are not. They are only known from their fossil records. But after millions of years of evolution, they cannot actually be the species we know of from the fossils. So they seem to be cryptids. Number 6 is similar to our second group. That is a creature not found in the fossil record, but is related to an existing animal. So where our second group were unusual examples of existing species, this would be me-like relatives to an existing animal. For example, the Andean wolf. It's a wolf, but an entirely new species. Let's label this group evolved cryptids. Similar to anomalous cryptids,